Dr. Laura Sykes is back. We're going to talk about some really fun, fascinating stuff in our February historical special edition. We're doing this every month in celebration of the Gazette's 150th anniversary. There's some cool stuff in here, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, I'm obsessed with something that's actually on the third page, which is the car bombing.
Yeah.
Okay, first of all, think about this. Like, in the 70s and 80s, there were car bombs all the time. Imagine if that happened today. Everyone would lose it. It's crazy.
Yeah. I've heard some crazy number about bombings in general during the 1970s.
There were something like 80 car bombings in the city of Cleveland in 1976 alone.
Wow.
People really liked it because it was a way that you could destroy your enemies without leaving evidence, because the fire and the conflagration burned everything up. Of course, they got better at finding, you know, who built the bombs and everything.
Right. Yeah. That and hijacking was big in the 70s. Lots of we think of now as especially turmoiled time, but at least stuff's not blowing up all the time.
I mean, really, I can't imagine, like, what people would have thought. And to be fair, having a car bombing in a town of, what, 50,000? That's pretty crazy.
Yeah, and, you know, I've been looking into this case. The man's name was Daryl Crouch. This happened in 1987. I'm sure plenty of people out there remember this. He was an executive at a pharmaceutical company here in town. And one day he just went outside. His daughter was in the car with him. He started the car. A pipe bomb went off. Daughter escaped with some burns. Wife was standing there and saw it. And I believe, I'm pretty sure of that one. Nobody ever could figure out even a suspect. Nobody knows why this happened. After all this time.
Wow, what a good mystery for someone to dig into.
Yeah, no kidding. Stay tuned. What else?
One of the things that I saw that was really interesting is this baby left for trash article. And we talked about this a little bit. Like, that's really sad. But luckily, the baby was saved. And I just think it's really interesting because we have a lot of things called baby Moses laws. Mm-hmm. Now, which allow you to surrender your babies. And the reason for that is because we did have these series of child abandonments that happened, especially in Texas in the 90s and the 80s. And it's a really sad story. But, you know, that child would be a fully grown adult now.
Yeah. This happened in
1993.
So be a 32-year-old now.
Yeah. They thought he was a baby doll.
Yeah. We talk about sort of journalism jargon is color means just sort of vibrant details. In this case, it was literal. They said the baby was blue sitting on top of the garbage, and they thought it was a doll. Then it starts whimpering, and they got it to the hospital.
That's so cool. And it's just beautiful that the baby survived. And wherever that baby is, we're sending all of our best.
Yes. I'm sure the Gazette followed up on the story, but we just have the one here. That's one thing about this is it's kind of maddening. It's like, what happened?
No, for sure. Another one that's like that is when it's talking about the 53rd Iranian hostage. You know, the Iranian hostage crisis that happened in 1979 when they had the revolution. One of the guys was from around here. And was eventually, of course, released, but lived over there for, you know, 500-something days, which has to be the most insane experience of your life. Talk about culture shock, right?
Yeah, no kidding. I was a kid then, 9 and 10 years old, and this made – it was huge in the culture, obviously. I think of that in retrospect as maybe one sort of – milestone on the right-left division that is so exaggerated now. There were people who wanted to go to war with Iran over this. And we can go into the October surprise sometime about how what was it, the day Reagan was inaugurated, they announced they were going to release the hostages.
Yeah, and they had organized it ahead of time.
Right, yeah.
And interestingly, one of our local guys ties into the Iranian story because H. Ross Perot had some hostages over there at the same time that the government did. But he also had his own personal SEAL team who went in and actually extricated them within days of the hostage crisis.
Right. And there was a book and a movie made about it. What was it called? On the Wings of Eagles or something like that. And I remember Richard Crenna played Ross Perot.
Oh, cool. Well, obviously, Ross Perot is a huge local figure. We're going to talk about him in our podcast episodes sometime in the future. Mm-hmm. But another story that is in here is the opening of the Perot Theater.
Post-renovation.
Yes. Yeah. So I guess it was pretty run down for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And Ross Perot is going to funnel $2 million into revitalizing it. And, of course, we call it the Perot Theater for a reason.
Yep.
But that is such an interesting thing to think about with Texarkana, about the influence that Perot had with all of that money, but not only having all that money, but spending it on civic stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which, you know, doesn't always happen.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so it was in danger, I think, of being torn down before all of the renovations happened. And now, of course, it's one of the mainstays of our cultural life here.
Yeah, and pretty widely recognized as just gorgeous architecturally.
Oh, we love it.
Yeah. Speaking of theaters, there's another story here from 1887 that is a gushing review of a Harmonic Society concert at the Opera House.
It's so funny to me to read these because I've actually read some accounts of the performers who were coming through to play in these. And they were like, oh, my gosh, this town is just full of mud. Nothing to do.
Right.
But the Tyser Cannons are like, yay, we're getting some culture in here. And we did. We had an opera house and we had other theaters and nationwide shows would come through here and play to local people, which, you know, it's one of the reasons that probably people like Scott Joplin got their start here because we have this, we created a cultural space in this city very early on.
Yeah. This particular thing seems to be local people, I think. Anyway, I just wanted to read some of this. We hardly know how to write about it. When we say that it was splendid success, we mean it just that way. And every participant so well performed the parts assigned that we feel it would be unjust to discriminate. Yet how can we avoid making a few special references? And then he goes on to sort of praise the individual performers. There was a guitar solo and a duet and many encores, et cetera, et cetera.
It's just funny. You're talking about color and newspapers. Well, I would say that this is definitely some purple prose.
Yeah, no kidding.
But I think it's great. And actually right under the tagline, it says there's like a sub tagline that says, let's have another soon in bold letters.
Right.
I think it was well enjoyed.
Yeah, it's so funny when they make those huge claims like everybody had a fabulous time and left with a grin on their face.
Wonderful. And I'm sure that they did. That must have been really fun for them. Mm-hmm. Less sort of pleasant is the main headline here and a couple of the really top headlines about the war. It's particularly World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Iwo Jima, U.S. planes sink warships. The interesting thing about this to me is not that World War II happened. We all know about that. But think about what it felt like to be a Texarkanan during the war.
Right.
What people were hearing about, what they were reading about. And we didn't have TV, you know, we did have radio, but it wasn't anywhere near what it would become. The newspaper would have been a place where you would have gotten all of this information and through the local lens, you know, which I think is something we don't always get these days.
Right. Yeah, both these stories are from 1945 involving a naval battle in the Pacific and the Battle of Iwo Jima, which has that famous photograph of the people raising the flag.
Which was recreated, right? So they did it first, right. And then they didn't get a good picture of it, so they went back and did it again.
Yeah, exactly.
We also have something that happens immediately after the war, which is really sort of in a post-war, perhaps an ex-GI context, which is the beginnings of the Moonlight Murders.
That's right. We get to the first attacks in February, 46.
Just after the war, so people would have been just coming right home.
Yeah, and I probably shouldn't say because I can't quite remember, but I think some of the victims were veterans.
Some of them were veterans.
Yeah.
And there's speculation that perhaps the Moonlight Murderer was themselves a veteran, perhaps with PTSD from the war, because it is really fast after the war. And men of a certain age would have all been involved.
Yeah, traumatized one way or another. But yeah, this is the first attack, a non-fatal attack on Jimmy Hollis and it's funny, they don't mention her name.
Just the girl.
Yeah, his 19-year-old girl companion. I'm sorry, I can't remember her name right now.
And, you know, this would have seemed very strange at the time, but it really wouldn't have made anyone think about what was coming. I mean, they're not killed, right?
Right.
And they're attacked, but they're not killed. And in fact, at one point, the Moonlight Murderer tells them to run, right?
Right, yeah.
Oh, I mean, that is like Scream stuff.
And this is where the idea of him wearing a bag on his head came from. This female victim, I need to look it up. I shouldn't.
You are a journalist.
That's right. I don't want to disrespect anyone.
She was hit over the head with a heavy, blunt object, apparently. There were some questions about how to treat the attack with regards to the girl, because there were questions about whether she was sexually assaulted or not. And this is the same with the later ones. The community was really curious about that. Mm-hmm. But the police were reluctant to release any information about that because it was still seen as kind of a private matter when sexual assaults like that happened.
Yeah, and you know, of course, women were subjected to a lot of shame just because they were victims. Let's see here. Mary Jean Larry. Yeah,
Mary Jean Larry.
She's the one who reported him wearing a mask, and she's the only one. Of course, in the movie, the town that dreaded sundown, he wears the hood over his head for the whole thing.
Well, it's so mysterious. It works so well as a creepy factor.
Yeah, absolutely. Turns him into a real monster.
When we talk about the Moonlight Murders in true crime class, the students are just fascinated by it. And I think that we continue to be fascinated by it. It's an unsolved mystery. The whole country was fascinated at the time that it was happening.
Yeah. And there's this sort of urban legend connection about couples on lovers' lanes. Remember the story of the hook? Mm. They drive away. They hear on the radio that a man with a hook for a hand has escaped from the insane asylum. And then they drive off, and when they get out of the car, there's a hook on the handle of the door.
It's so creepy. But, you know, there's also a moral storytelling element to that.
Yeah, absolutely.
You better not go necking or something. Right. You might get caught by the hook guy.
And that carries right on through to the slasher movies of the 1980s, where Jason Voorhees was sure to kill everyone who expressed any sexuality or drank or any other vice.
Speaking of, Carl, could you tell me something about the social evil?
Yes. Apparently, it's the worst thing that could possibly happen to anybody.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I love that we've got competing moral panics in this edition.
Where things change.
Yeah, there's a 1914 story about the Round Table Club discussing the social evil, i.e., prostitution is what they're talking about.
Well, prostitution has been with this town since its very beginning, as we talked about in our railroad episode.
Yeah. And there's a long excerpt of when Dr. Maddox's speech about this problem and how dire it is. Let's see if I can read some of that to you.
says on the headline, scant dress is attacked.
Right.
Right. So trying to control the way that women dress and their sexuality is certainly a central topic here.
Right. So he goes into what are the causes of this? Quote, sensuality. This is a part of the makeup of all normal men. From this, our good women do much to protect us.
Help.
Right. indolence. This is a cause which is as dangerous to women as to men, if not more so. The idle man or the idle woman is in grave danger of getting into sin and is sure to be sorely tempted, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. And, you know, Texarkana has always had this reputation as being sort of a crossroads between the South, the West, and we've always had a lot of people coming through here as a result. And we have had, well, as the article says, the guy in 1914 acknowledges, as long as we've had any history, we find this, right?
Yeah.
And so that's the same case with Texarkana, but certainly they were very concerned about it. And I imagine that the changes that were happening around the same time with women probably heightened their concerns about what was going on.
Yeah, no kidding. So we also have two other stories declaring other things to be the worst.
Most evil.
Right, exactly. From February 2nd, 1925. Quote, worst devil in Texarkana, unquote, is declared to be lawlessness and liquor combined.
I mean, if you think about it, the largest organizations in this country during this period and the largest women's organization in the whole country were temperance organizations. Mm-hmm. This is a very popular topic at the time. A lot of people think that if they get rid of alcohol, they'll get rid of problems like poverty, like spousal abuse and child abuse, prostitution, things like that. Now, I have to give you a spoiler alert because we're actually going to try this out and it doesn't work, right? Prohibition. But
when did it take effect?
Prohibition started in 1919. Yeah.
Okay.
And then lasted all the way through the 20s and was reversed, I think, in 31.
So these stories are being written in the middle of Prohibition and they're still talking about liquor.
Well, you have to realize that the people who are going to be to the people who are still engaging in liquor are probably right. The worst of the worst.
Of course.
Right. And of course, we know in reality that the liquor never went anywhere. It just went underground,
right.
Which is, you know, the same thing that happened all over the country. But yeah, I mean, the South was a real hotbed of that. The churches in the South in particular were very pro-prohibition. And so I can imagine that the fervor for it here would have been extremely high. And we, of course, had these liquor laws on the books until, what, the 2000s? I think it was a dry county. Bowie County was a dry county until, like, the 2000s or something.
Right. And it's only even more recent than that than other cities in the area started legalizing beer and wine sales.
So I think that this has had a very long shadow on Texarkana. I mean, now, of course, I don't think the prohibition experiment will be tried again as it was a spectacular failure. But certainly the influence of alcohol is going to continue to be a concern of people around here.
Yeah, absolutely. Morris Shepherd was a U.S. senator from Texarkana, and he is known as the father of prohibition. In 1913, he introduced a constitutional amendment to prohibit the manufacture, sale, or transportation of intoxicating liquors. And that eventually became ratified as the 18th Amendment in 1919. So there you go.
I was right about the day, thank goodness.
Yeah.
You know, historians are sometimes touch and go on actual dates.
There's a lot of dates in there.
There's just, and it's numbers, and historians are not known to be the numbers guys, right?
Right.
One of the things that I really think is interesting in here is that we get a 911 system.
Oh, yeah, that's really cool.
What does it mean, like, to live in a world without 911?
Well, I can tell you. The thing you were supposed to do is just dial zero for the operator and ask him to connect you to the police or whatever.
Or whatever. And so the thing is, in addition to having to call the operator would have to decide who to patch you through to. So what if you had a situation where you needed a fire, ambulance, and police, then it would be a much more complicated process, right? Yeah,
absolutely. It's so much better to have the centralized dispatching and record keeping and everything.
It saved a lot of lives, but one of the earliest concerns with it was, like, who's going to pay for this? And we still have a lot of federal and state funding for programs like that.
We should say this story is from 1977, and it's about Clarksville.
And, you know, there's another one here from 1977, which I think is interesting, where we actually have an African-American history performance here of a musical in 1977 by the Kappa Xi Omega chapter of Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority, which is one of the big African-American sororities. And I think that's really interesting because we obviously live in a time where people are discussing issues of multiculturalism and plurality. And as early as 1977, we had people advocating for, and of course before, but in this public setting, had people advocating for broader history and more voices to be included.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they're bringing a show to town.
Yes.
That's called Voices Incorporated.
We also have here an article about integration, right? Because school segregation was obviously very entrenched here, and there's a lot of local resistance to desegregation. And in fact, we even have articles from the Gazette at the time where they quote people who are blaming communist infiltrators for convincing people to have integration, which, you know, I don't think it would take that. Okay. But
it's interesting. This story is sort of a retrospective, a look back. It's 1987, looking back 20 years prior.
Yeah, and it's talking about the experience and particularly the integration of Dunbar High School, which we know was the black school was Dunbar High School. And we know that that was a beloved school within the community that served its students very well. But because of integration, we have the community moving on to this new experiment, this new endeavor. And looking back on it from 1987, the superintendent is really talking about what happened in the past and how we did things right and how we did things wrong and what we can improve, which I think is a great approach to take.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think we've about covered it all.
One more. The space shuttle explosion.
Oh, that's right.
Challenger.
There's an op-ed piece here by Rodney Burgess from February 2nd, 1986, which is it's less than a week after the space shuttle Challenger disaster when it exploded on launch. And he's talking about how we could have seen it coming.
And a lot of people did see it coming. The space shuttle program was complicated by, you know, political processes in Washington. We know that the O-ring fell, that other people had called attention to the issues of the O-ring before the Challenger exploded.
Yeah.
I think for a lot of people, the question is, are we going to keep going with this? And as we know, what ends up happening is that the space shuttle program is actually put on hiatus and then gradually brought back, but never in the form that it was supposed to take.
Yeah.
And of course, the headline or the first line of this article is, we obviously have a major malfunction, which is going to become a very popular catchphrase in American popular culture.
Yeah.
But for a lot of people, this moment all over the country, but also here in Texarkana, this moment was really a touchstone of the 1980s. And it would have deeply affected, especially, I think, young people some of whom were actually watching the launch. And I think that when you talk to people about important things that happened in their youth, if they're from this era, this is always going to pop up.
Yeah, I was 15, a few weeks from turning 16, and I remember we were at the lunch table and a teacher came in and told us.
Yeah, it's one of those moments where people know where they were, when it happened. Of course, Krista McAuliffe, who was the first civilian and also a school teacher, was mm-hmm. on the flight. And that really had a lot of caused a lot of sorrow for the whole nation.
Yeah.
And it just we weren't sure what that's what's really cool about this whole endeavor is like you can see what it looked like to read about these things from the perspective of the time. At the time, you don't know what's going to happen. Are we going to go back to space? Are we going to keep doing this or not?
Yeah.
Like, what's going to happen? Now we know the story, right? Mm-hmm. Because we have the privilege of being in the future.
Yeah.
But if you're going through these articles, you can just imagine being there in those moments and sort of wondering what the future might hold.
Right. And now we're entering a whole new era where space travel is commercialized, privatized.
We're going to see what happens, you know? We got some guys up there for a while now.
Yeah, the one thing NASA could never do is afford to just blow a bunch of them up when they were trying them out.
So we'll see what happens. I mean, maybe we will enter into a new phase of space travel where people watching launches at school again might become a thing.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Thanks so much. This is really fun and interesting as always.
Thank you, Carl.